The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with SuperValue Travel Insurance. Don't worry about a thing with Great Value Travel Insurance online at supervalue.ie.
Hello and good morning. I hope you are well and that you're having a happy Easter. It is a lovely morning here in Dublin. We hope it's nice where you are. And today marks the official countdown to the centenary of the Easter Rising. Dublin in 1915 was a city in turmoil on the cusp of great change. And today O'Connell Street will come alive as RTE recreates the atmosphere of the time in the road to Rising. Well, our man Colm Flynn's down there and he joins me on the line now.
John, you've just caught me as I'm hopping onto a tram here in the middle of O'Connell Street, just outside the GPO. Where is this tram going?
This particular tram is on its way to Dalkey.
Okay, I have my ticket there. Can you take
that? You have your ticket? Yeah, that's correct.
Is that valid?
Go straight in. The sliding door's a bit creaky. I'll open up for you.
John, this is some sight. And first of all, what a glorious morning it is here in Dublin City Centre this morning. O'Connell Street has been pedestrianised for Roads of the Rising, and it is packed. Down towards the Ambassador, I can see a beautiful Victorian carousel that will be spinning shortly. People can hop on all day. There are tents, there's a band stage. And John, I am standing on the main attraction, what I think is the main attraction this morning, a beautiful tram that would have been commonplace here on O'Connell Street and throughout Dublin in 1915. You'd want to see this, John.
Great stuff. And Colm, I presume crowds are gathering already. The official start is not until about 11 o'clock.
Yeah, it all kicks off at 11 o'clock and then runs throughout the day. There are different things happening like reenactments, there are talks, there are performances. You can come and you can see the exhibitions like this one here. But the tram that I'm after stepping onto, Jim Kilroy is in charge of this. Jim, what kind of tram is this?
Well, this particular type of tram replaced the horse trams. Dublin horse trams commenced in 19...
Oh, I think we've...
This particular type of tram had no windscreen. The driver was out in the open. He was exposed to the elements. And that's because with the horse trams, you couldn't have the leads to control the horses. So they decided that the poor driver with the electric trams, quite forgetting, of course, it went at the phenomenal speed of 15 miles an hour. It's called an open front tram.
And let's walk into it now, yes, Jim, because we're going in. It's mainly wood it's made out of. And I hear that sometimes they could have been a bit of a fire hazard.
Well, there are a few stories about trams going on fire. There was one on the Hillifold system where people used to drop their tickets into the bulkhead. It was a little hollow where the windows dropped. And somebody dropped a cigarette butt and the tram went on fire. There were cases like that. Now, in 1916, when the Rising was here and when HMS Helga, it's bullets or shells, the street. It hit a Howth tram, which was parked right over there at North Earl Street, blasting it, killing it, if you like. And that tram was turned on its side and was used by the insurgents in 1916. This particular tram went on fire. I was restoring it in Howth in a barn, Jerry O'Brien's old stables. Jerry's long gone. And the barn went on fire. And originally I was restoring it as a Cork tram because at a different full canopy arrangement. It's a little bit technical, but the fire burnt off the canopies, so I replaced them with a shorter canopy, typical of the Dublin Dalkey tram.
Well, John, normally this is in the National Transport Museum out in Howth, but you can come and see it today. It's just outside the GPO here on O'Connell Street. You can hop on board the tram. You can go upstairs because there is an upstairs too. Get your photograph taken in it. So this is the place to be. It's all kicking off at 11. But John, I'll talk to you in a little while with another taster here from the street.
Great stuff, Colm. And as Colm mentioned, it is a lovely day here in Dublin this morning. I'm joined now by Mark Duncan, who is director of Century Island. And Century Island are involved in curating aspects of today's Road to the Rising programme. And Mark joins me now. Mark, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
And I mean, I know there's a vast array of events taking place today, but the fact that the sun is shining is also a help.
It's absolutely gorgeous out there this morning, so I think they're going to have a huge crowd. I know there was huge interest in an awful lot of the events which required a bit of pre-booking, although everything today is free. There's some events that required a bit of pre-booking, so that kind of gives you a sense of just the kind of atmosphere which has been kind of building up over the last week. And I think, as you said, because of the weather and because there's just so much laid on with a family focus, I think you're going to have a big crowd in there.
It's been a question that's been asked quite a bit about why are we celebrating or at least marking 1915. What would you say?
Well, I suppose we're taking a step back here. This is Ireland on the cusp of revolution, you know, and this is obviously the 1916 rebellion is an event that, as everyone knows, transformed the direction of Irish history. But one of the great merits of an event like today and the sheer breadth of activity is it enables people to engage with the lived experience. What was it like to live in Ireland of 1915? And as you kind of heard from the streets there, you know, by going into O'Connell Street today, you'll get to see the sights, the sounds, the various types of experiences of what it was like to live like at that time.
And the First World War, Mark, underpinned everything, but it wasn't the only thing going on.
No. The First World War, obviously, we're edging towards rebellion, but the First World War is now 8 months up and running and has transformed the political landscape of the country. It impinges on people in a different way, but it has radically transformed the political outlook. And just to kind of, just to maybe appreciate just how much it has, just look what was happening in the months leading up to the outbreak of the First World War. Ireland appeared to be heading towards civil war. You had two massive private armies debating the issue of Home Rule. So war actually leads to a peace of a sorts in Ireland. You know, acts as a bit of a valve. You know, it releases the pressure. But of course, what happens in the wake of the war? You have a small group of advanced nationalists who begin planning a rising. There are, of course, other groups. Ireland, during this period, is very much like a mold. So you have all different organisations trying to shape the Ireland that is about to come into being. You have the Irish suffragette movement, very much part of an international movement who are looking to extend votes to women. And in these years, they're not afraid to take what we might regard as militant action, up to and including going on hunger strike. In fact, in late 1913, you find them defacing busts of John Redmond. You find them in the lead up to Christmas pouring corrosive fluid into letterboxes to attack the postal service. You have the rise of Labour and the trade union movement, who are looking for a completely different social and economic order. You have the Gaelic revivalists, who are insistent that a new politically autonomous or separate Ireland is not only different, but culturally distinct. So it values its cultural traditions, its language, its music, its customs, its games.
What about the standard of living back then?
Well, I suppose it depended on where you were. If you look at a city like Dublin, it's very much a city of extremes. You know, it's both expanding and in decline at the same time. And this is a process which has been ongoing over many decades. So you have a growth of an awful lot of suburbs, which would have been outlying villages and towns, like sort of Rathmines, Monkstown, Blackrock in the south side of Dublin, Drumcondra and Clontarf on the north side of Dublin. And these would have grown partly due to a flight of wealth from the inner city, but also due to an expanding middle class. Now, you know, against all that, the inner city is falling into decay, and Dublin is home to some of the worst slums in Europe. The 1911 census found that 20,000 families lived in single-roomed accommodation. You know, the crisis of Dublin tenements was a spot brought home to many people in September 1913, when two tenement buildings on Church Street collapsed. Seven people were killed in that, including children. And that gives rise to a Dublin housing inquiry. The Dublin housing inquiry is fascinating for a number of reasons. It does its work really, really quick, publishes a report in February 1914. And what it does is underline the extent to which many Dubliners lived in overcrowded, insanitary conditions. One house they found 98 people living in.
How many rooms would have been in that house?
Well, that was possibly one of those buildings like Henrietta Street, I suppose, is that kind of classic street which was once fashionable in the 19th century, has fallen into decay, is now kind of a tenement dwelling. Most of the homes were little more than shelters. Outside the tenements, some of the houses and cottages were little more than shelters at the time. And one of the most damning aspects of that report is that members of Dublin corporations were beneficiaries of the tenement system. They were landlords, availing of tax rebates. The other interesting thing about the report is the appendix to the report was populated by photographs which were submitted by evidence by a man called John Cook, who was an inspector with the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. This is a forerunner of the ISPCC. He went through the streets of Dublin in late 1913, October, November, and took photographs of some of the dwellings, of some of the collapsed buildings and submitted them as part of evidence. And people who go into O'Connell Street today will be able to kind of see some of those images. They're part of what is now known as the Darkest Dublin Collection, which is maintained by the Royal Society of Antiquaries of Ireland.
There was squalor, as you've pointed out, but there was a lot of wealth as well, and a lot of people frequented Grafton Street as they do today.
Well, Grafton Street then as now was one of the most fashionable streets, and actually it was so busy and so congested that in May 1915, the chief of the Dublin Metropolitan Police started instructing his officers to ensure that horse-drawn carriages and motor cars would be limited in the amount of time they could actually spend there, so they could only just kind of drop people off and then move on, you know. You would have likes of Switzers on Grafton Street at the time, but an awful lot of the big department stores that we'd be familiar with now, Arnott's, Cleary's, Boyer's, they were all around at the time, you know, and you see them in the newspapers at the time. They are the ones advertising it, and you talk about fashion, I suppose, a lot of the styles they're advertising in the newspapers to most people's eyes would look as very elegant and stylish, but it wasn't always to everyone's liking. There was one woman who wrote to a newspaper late 1913 and said to walk through Grafton Street at the time was to see women who were barely clad and who, adopting the fashions from France and America, were content to go about almost as savages.
Brazen, I see.
Brazen.
Yeah, and what about sport in 1915? What was the story?
Well, sport's a really good way kind of see how the war impacts on people's leisure activities. Sport, you know, the birth of sport had really taken place in the late 19th century. We see the emergence of all these new sporting organisations. Sport becomes a really popular form of pastime, of participation. And in the case of All-Ireland finals and rugby internationals and race meetings, it's a big... big business, big spectator, big spectator sports. When the war breaks out, you see a cancellation of fixtures. You see the abandonment of some activities. The Dublin Horse Show in 1914 is cancelled immediately because the military authorities start occupying the grounds. You know, they bring horses into the RDS grounds. You see the cancellation of the Irish amateur golf competition in Portrush, but. Sport, different sports, as I said, respond differently. So the IRFU cancelled a lot of fixtures. The president of the IRFU, Frank Browning, encourages members, players, to enlist in the war. And in a club just not far from where these studios are, Belvedere, out of 300 members, 130 enlist in the war. Over 72 of them are killed. The GAA also has members who enlist in the war, including two players who would have played in All-Ireland hurling football finals in 1914. They also include, of course, many leading officials who would be very vocal in their opposition into recruitment. But by and large, they try and maintain a normal programme of activities, you know. The crowds decline slightly. The 1914 All-Ireland football final, for instance, has a crowd of 15,000, but 25 trains are bringing supporters into Dublin for that from all around the country. So it's still very much a national event. People are on the move and attending fixtures. Golf, what do? It's a really popular pastime for a particular class of people, most of whom would have been supportive of the war, but they grapple with the appropriateness of actually going out and playing golf at a time when so many people are fighting and dying in the trenches of France.
And cricket was a very popular pastime at that stage.
Cricket was. There's a photograph in an exhibition today which shows a massive crowd in College Green in Trinity College attending a fixture, which would have been right from the early 1900s. And of course, College Park would have been a very popular venue for sport. The college races were first held there in the 1850s, and it remained a very kind of popular venue for it. Cricket outside of Dublin, you know, had been very popular in likes of Kilkenny and Tipperary, strongholds of rugby, but had begun to go into decline, not just because of the rise of hurling in those counties, but because, I suppose, of the whole Gaelic revival movement, you know, that kind of got caught in the cultural crossfire where everything had to be defined as either native or foreign.
Mm. And Mark, I suppose war impacts differently on different people. How were farmers, the wives of soldiers, nationalists affected?
Well, I suppose if anyone benefited from the war was the farmers. And the, you know, the wartime conditions created something of a bonanza for them, because the prices went sky high, and there were a lot of widespread allegations of profiteering on their part. You know, the harvest of 1914 was achieved the best prices since the 1880s. You know, and it probably explains why so few farmers' sons were actually enlisting in the army. This is something that comes through in a lot of the reports that flow into Dublin Castle, where the British administration was based. You know, a lot of people kind of worried, how do we get farmers' sons to enlist? They're not doing it. They're not doing it because simply there's so much work. It's so profitable to be working on the land during that time.
So it's a bit like the equivalent back in 1915 of the quotas, milk quotas being lifted now.
Well, somewhat. I mean, you also mentioned, you know, soldiers' wives. Soldiers' wives, I mean, it's hard to think of them as beneficiaries, since so many of them ended the war as widows or raising families on their own, or kind of, you know, or they had broken husbands coming back to them. But a separation allowance was introduced when the war broke out. So many women, for the very first time in their lives, had money of their own. You know, the first time they were actually independent in that sort of way. And of course, there are reports, there's a sort of a moral panic that women are spending money in the pubs and drinking too much, you know, and so you see that kind of coming through as well.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I know to avoid making the same mistakes over and over again, we should learn from history. Why is it important then to remember 1915?
Well, I suppose we need to kind of take stock of where Ireland was before everything changed. Even if you think about walk the streets of Dublin today along O'Connell Street, you know, an awful lot of this was destroyed the following year, and everyone will be familiar with the photographs of decay and what have you. So this is looking at the Ireland just before the Rising, which transformed everything, you know. 1914, there was a big commemoration around the war last year, because the war transformed thousands of Irish people's lives, you know, and many homes were only now beginning to kind of recognise that. 1916 did the same for different reasons.
Thank you for joining us this morning. That's Mark Durkin, Director of Century Ireland. And we were talking there about what was happening in Ireland back in 1915, but what about the rest of the world? Fergus Sweeney joins me. Fergus, you've been looking at different aspects of life around the world in the year 1915, and what have you come up with?
Yeah, facts and figures, John, just looking at what life was like in 1915 outside Ireland. I want to start with film. And the birth of the Irish film industry can be traced to 1915. We'll find out a little bit more about that a little later. Brian Redden, a filmmaker, is going to tell us about a film called Fun at Finglas Fair. It's got the alliteration. I wonder what else it's got. But it apparently was the very first dramatic film made in Ireland. And it was lost in 1916. That's all I tell you about it at the moment, because there's a dramatic story behind it. Sure. So Brian will be here a little later to fill us in on that. But the film I want to concentrate in on is a Hollywood film called Inspiration. And the reason why is because it's actually the first film in the world to feature a nude scene in it. Yeah, it was an actress called Audrey Munson. I've never heard of her. The film, I looked it up on IMDb, the internet database, and in fact I wasn't the only one looking it up there. In the message board there are two or three others wondering where they can get a copy of this film. I would have thought with all the internet, the interesting internet sites out there now, that you don't need to be going back to 1915 to get your thrills. But anyway, the description of the film, it says it's a young sculptor searches for the perfect model to inspire his work. So it's in France, it was called Sublime Beauté,
right.
Inspiration. Now, interesting, the actress Audrey Munson appeared in another film in 1916. She only did a small number of films altogether, and it was called Purity. Now, it sounds like the exact same film, just a remake of it. It says a simple country girl comes to the city and is hired as an artist's model. We get the picture. A young poet becomes obsessed with her and is distraught when he learns she has been posing nude. So it appeared that Audrey Munson's career did revolve around taking her clothes off.
Fergus, what about Stonehenge in 1915?
Yeah, Stonehenge was sold in 1915 to the lock millionaire Cecil Chubb. We'll all be familiar with Chubb locks. We probably all have them in our house. He was a millionaire in 1915, walked into an auction in Salisbury and for 6,600 sterling bought Stonehenge, a private estate with 30 acres, but he bought it for his wife, but she didn't want it. She was very displeased that she had been given Stonehenge. What is this thing? Stonehenge had been in the in the family of the Antrobus family since the Middle Ages. And the heir to the Antrobus family was killed in World War One, and then it went up for auction. And so when the wife of Cecil Chubb didn't want the land, he donated it to the state. And he put a couple, 3 years later, he donated it to the state, and he put a couple of conditions on him handing it over to the state, one of which was that the entrance fee shouldn't be no more than a shilling. Now, I've never been to Stonehenge, so I don't know what you pay to get in these days and whether it's still only a shilling. And also the other condition he made on giving it over to the state was that local residents should get in for nothing.
I see. Yeah, interesting. Mm. And the wife not impressed at all.
No.
Yeah, she wasn't a woman of culture. Now, the neon lights in Times Square, they owe their existence to 1915.
They do indeed. The neon tube sign was patented by a French inventor called George Claude in 1915. He had presented his idea 5 years earlier at the Paris Motor Show. And as you know, the neon tube sign became particularly popular in the 20s and 40s, 20s to 40s in the United States. And you couldn't go to any downtown city without the neon signs. And I wonder, because it never had struck me where the name came from. Would you have a guess at where the name came from, neon?
Haven't a notion.
Well, yeah. It's named after a noble gas called neon. It seems obvious now that you hear it. And the neon gas has an orange light, but then other gases and chemicals are used to produce other colours, like hydrogen is used to produce the red, helium for the yellow, etc., etc. So, yeah, Times Square would not be Times Square without the neon light, and they owe their existence to George Claude.
I see, thank you. Anything of interest about the music of the day?
Yeah, just a few things, and I think you'll be learning to play the ukulele a little later on.
I will be, yeah.
You were out learning the ukulele during the week. But the ukulele became popular after an appearance at the Panama Pacific International Exposition in San Francisco in 1915. French composer Claude Debussy became one of the first person to receive a colostomy in 1915. And we can also talk about there's a few people, a few famous musicians that were born. Edith Piaf was born
in 1915.
Yeah, Edith Piaf, Billie Holiday, Ewan McCall as well, born in 1915. And I suppose modern music and the business that it is today owes its existence to the recording and sale of popular music from 1915. And we can have a listen to some of the tunes of that era.
Great stuff. One Irish company that's expected to see their business surge in the run-up to the 1916 commemorations is Prospect Designs. They're a small company located on Camden Street here in Dublin, and they make flags. Think about it, you'll probably buy a tricolour yourself in the run-up to 2016. Well, last week I visited Prospect Designs and I met the owner, Ken Cairns.
Well, we do everything from company flags to scouting flags, naval flags for the ships. We have the crests of all the naval ships that ever were in the Irish Naval Service. We've done all of the flags for every one of them. You know, then you have the company flags, national flags of different countries. And we also do the, for state visits, we do the flags for the cars, whatever dignitaries in it.
How big a part of the business is the tricolour?
Tricolour would be probably about 20% of it. Because you have tricolours of all different sizes, you know, from the very big ones, like the GPO, it would be 6 foot by 12 foot, down to the little ones on sailing boats, which might be only 9 inches by 12 inches.
And when it comes down to the business and over the years, how has it evolved? I can see the women in there on their sewing machines, but is it very high tech now at this stage?
Well, everything is designed by computer now. Back at the early 90s, we were really stuck for space. But then with computerization, we were able to free up a lot more space for doing things because screen printing was gone. This was all done by laser.
Over the years, you've supplied, obviously, a lot of big events. What was the biggest event?
The biggest event was the Pope visit, definitely by far. We'd queues out the street for paper flags for it. And in the end, it got to such a state, we were working 7 days a week for that, you know, between 60, 70 hours we were putting in every week. And in the end, it got so busy that we supplied them with a square of yellow cloth and a square of the papal crest. Make your own flags.
go off to yourself. Do you notice your own flags? Are you able to tell when you're travelling along and look at a tricolour or another flag that it's yours?
Oh, yes, definitely. You'd know them from a long way off. Oh, you just know the way they sit and the stitch of them and that type of thing from the distance and the type of rope and fitting that's in it as well.
As part of the business, you get to know in advance when VIPs are visiting Ireland.
Oh, we would, yes. Yeah. And we'd have the crests of all the different countries on the computer. So we're able to make them up instantly, sometimes same day.
And Ken, will you be getting a lot of business out of the commemorations of 1916?
Oh, yes, it'd make a big difference, especially with the green, white and orange flag and then some of the flags from the Rising and that type of thing that were flown over the GPO, the copies of that and that type of thing.
And before I let you go, can you tell us about the phone call from NASA?
Well, a phone call from NASA came on a Friday night at 7 o'clock. This man came on the phone and said he was from NASA. We didn't believe him at first, you know, and that type of thing. But Foreign Affairs came back a short time later and said, no, it is him, really is, man from NASA. So he wanted a flag to take up on the shuttle. So it was a green, white and orange, and his family were from Kerry. So he wanted a connection with Kerry, and being a golfer, he put the crests of the golf clubs of Kerry on his flag and took it up into space.
I see. So that one of your flags got to space.
Yes. And we've been on Everest and we've been in North and South Pole. And we had another order a couple of years ago we did for Gulf Air, which is now, I think, Emirates. And we had to do two flags of every country in the world for the Saudi palace for the driveway up to it. So that was a big order, kept us going for a long time.
It's fascinating what you do here. And please God, business will be very good for you in the next 12 months or so.
Let's hope so.
And that was Ken Kearns there, the man who runs Prospect Designs, looking forward to many tricolour sales in the next 12 months. Now, in the run-up to the Rising, for the first time, politics, nationalism, culturalism and feminism were combined. I'm joined now by an expert on the subject. Katrina Crowe is Head of Special Projects at the National Archives of Ireland. Katrina, you're very welcome.
Thank you, John.
And you've a busy day ahead of you.
Very busy day. And luckily, the weather is beautiful.
So it is. That'll bring the people out.
It really will. And I'm sure they're going to enjoy themselves. It looks like a terrific project.
And what are you doing at the Abbey later on?
I'm talking about social conditions in Dublin on the eve of the 1916 Rising.
I see.
So just what was going on in terms of social class and all of that, with lots and lots of pictures. So there'll be things for people to look at and amuse them, I hope.
And tell us about some of those pictures, what they depict.
Well, Mark Duncan already spoke to you about the Darkest Dublin collection, which is the collection of photographs taken by John Cook of Tenement Dublin. And what's remarkable about that collection is that there are interior shots. It's very unusual in Europe at that time to have shots of interior working class housing. So you can actually see what a single occupancy dwelling was like, where a family of seven may have lived in one room, as 20,000 families did. There's all of that. There's photographs of Cleary's sale for hats in the summer and how much they were going to cost. And you compare those with what the wages of, say, a servant might have been at the time. What else do I have? I've been thinking about this rather than that, so it's not on my mind at the moment.
Sure.
But there's no shortage of photographic evidence.
Right.
That I finish actually with, you were talking about the destruction of Dublin. Poor old O'Connell Street was wrecked three times during this decade. 1916, the War of Independence and the Civil War. I mean, it is banjacks by the end of it all. Our poor old capital city, you know,
yeah,
which actually was a very pretty street. What's remarkable is that they managed to rebuild it so quickly and make it so beautiful, and that now we've ruined it again.
Yes, you think so.
Without benefit of war.
Yeah, so. Right. And Katrina, Mark touched a little bit on it about the suffragettes back in these times. What was life like for women in Ireland in 1915?
For women in Ireland generally, well, the suffragettes, I suppose, are a special case because they're a small minority, people like Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and Margaret Cousins. And the big suffragette fuss is kind of over at this stage because the war has changed everything. It's really 1912 to 13 when you have the Cat and Mouse Act. They're engaging in acts of civil disobedience, like breaking windows with very delicate little hammers, which I've seen an example of. Hard to believe they could break any kind of a window. And then being arrested for civil psychiatric disorder, going on hunger strike in jail, being let out when they're too ill and put back in. None of them did anything as extreme as the WSP, the Women's Social and Political Union in Britain. Two of those people came over, Mary Lee and Gladys Evans, came to Ireland in 1912 and tried to burn down the Olympia Theatre, the Palace Theatre as it was then, as you do, and also threw a hatchet into the Prime Minister's carriage, narrowly missing him. So they ended up in jail on hunger strike, and they were the only people to be force-fed because the authorities weren't having two English suffragettes dying on their hands. They were going to make damn sure that they got their food. Very unpleasant experience, it must be said, to be force-fed. So you've got the suffragettes on the one hand, you've got the broad mass of women on the other hand, many of whom do not approve of votes for women. The usual internalisation of the oppressor, they don't see why they should be able to vote. They think things are fine as they are and that their husband's vote can represent them. Poor women in the cities have a pretty bad time. Very high child mortality. We have evidence, for example, of a house in Buckingham Street where there were 49 people living in eight families, all in single room dwellings. And one of them, Marjorie Dixon, gave birth to 13 children and lost seven of them. And that really confounds our idea today, because we have very good child mortality rates in Ireland now. Of what do you do when you lose that many children? How do people get over that kind of trauma?
Sure.
So that's a huge thing. Childbirth is dangerous. Quite a large number of women die in childbirth. And if you look at the 1911 census, you see a remarkable number of men who have remarried, having lost their first wife, usually to childbirth. So those would be the big things. Very hard work. Particularly if you lived in a tenement house, because you would have to carry water. Water is, as now, a big deal. So usually there would have been one tap serving the whole house down at the back of the house. If you happened to be unfortunate enough to live on the top floor, you had to carry two heavy buckets of water. And I've done it just to see what it was like up to the top floor, and then be very clever how you used it. Wash the people first, the delf second, and then the floor, so that you're getting three uses out of the water. Middle-class women are starting to have a better time because, as Mark said earlier, the suburbs are starting to expand and there are newer houses being built, and many of those have electric light. Mr. Edison has invented electric light. This is a great new thing, although some women didn't like it because it shone light into dark corners full of dust and cobwebs that could have stayed just as they were if they didn't have the benefit of the light. We have flush toilets arriving on the scene, which is a hell of a lot better than the ash pit at the end of the garden having to be cleaned out by the night soil man regularly, one of the more unpleasant jobs of the time. And you have running water, so you'd have the old Belfast sinks appearing in people's sculleries in places like Rathmines and Drumcondra and so on. Fashion is very important to women, to working class women as much as to richer women. And at this point, they're moving from the S-bend corset, which is one of the more agonising garments, I have to say, that I've ever come across. The aim was to achieve a 20-inch waist. Now, there may be some people alive today with 20-inch waist, probably supermodels, but it's not usual, and it certainly wasn't usual then either. So you were laced into this thing full of bones that was supposed to drag you into this very unpleasant shape, to make your bottom stick out and your bosom stick out above it, creating an effect like a monobosom, as it was called by the woman who invented the bra.
Yes. Because that invention came in 1914.
That came in 1914. Yeah. Polly Phelps in America was going to a ball one night and she was being laced into her S-bend by her maid and said, to hell with this. I do not want to wear this damn thing anymore. Bring me two pocket handkerchiefs and some ribbon. And with that, she constructed the first bra and was admired hugely by the people at the ball for her fluid appearance, whatever that may mean. Anyway, she patented the thing and it became very popular. Now, it hasn't got to Ireland by 1915, but it's going to arrive fairly soon. The silhouette is changing, the kinds of clothes are changing, the war has made a difference because there's a shortage of material, as there always is in wars, because it's used for uniforms and for nurses' outfits and so on. So skirts get shorter and ankles are now revealed for the first time. So shoes become more important. And there's lovely kid button boots in pastel colours with short heels that come into fashion, and patterned stockings because you can see people's ankles.
But presumably the working class wives wouldn't necessarily have had the money to spend on the fashion of the day.
They wouldn't on the high fashion. And high fashion is bought in the big stores, in Switzer's, in Cleary's, in Arnott's. They are for upper middle class women by and large. Other women had their clothes made by their local dressmaker. And there were 6,000 dressmakers in Dublin at the time and 3,000 milliners. So what ordinary women, working class women, lower middle class women would do is get from a magazine a picture of something they liked, bring it along to their corner dressmaker and say, Mary, can you make me this? And she could. And it was a whole lot cheaper than buying anything in the stores. So most clothes were made by local dressmakers or homemade at the time for poorer women. There was a huge trade in hats too, because women wore hats regularly. It was seen as unrespectable to be going about without a hat. So for that, you went to your milliner and she would do the hat for you. But when you start to look, the other thing that becomes scarce in the war is metal, and that also leads to the demise of the corset, because the corset had to be laced up with metal hooks at the back. And when that goes out, it makes it easier for the bra to triumph. And it's really ironic, actually, that the garment that spelled liberation for women in 1915 became the symbol of oppression in the 1970s and started to be burned by women.
Yes.
So that's the way it goes. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, there were very beautifully well-dressed women in the upper classes who would have also used dressmakers, but very high-end dressmakers to make very expensive dresses covered in sequins and beads and so on. And then your average woman would wear a skirt just above the ankles, bunch of underwear underneath, a jacket and a hat, and get about her business then.
What about diet back then?
Well, working class diet very, very poor. We know from the commission that Mark described into the conditions of the working classes that most people in the tenements had a diet of bread, butter, tea, sugar, the odd feed of bacon and cabbage, and sometimes herrings as a cheap fish, and potatoes. So it was a very carbohydrate-rich diet, which makes sense if you're going out to do heavy physical work, as a lot of the men would have been. They would have been carters, dockers, general labourers, doing heavy lifting, but absolutely deficient in vitamins and protein. And it meant children often suffered from rickets because they were lacking in vitamins. No vegetables or fruit mentioned. The middle class diet, very meat heavy, on the other hand. 5 pounds of meat per person per week, which seems a lot to us now. A lot of that being rashers for your breakfast. And I would advise everyone, if they're doing a high tea today in any of the restaurants in O'Connell Street and rashers feature, have them. They're very bad for you, but they're delicious. And it's one of those lovely things that has gone out now, but they're very scrumptious. So a lot of people had rashers. And again, we look at what it was like to eat out. This is the menu and the prices for a pub in Leinster Alley, which was near Nassau Street. So the typical menu would be a steak or a chop, sixpence. Potatoes and bread, no charge. A glass of draft stout, a penny. Cheese, bread and butter, tuppence. A glass of port, tuppence. And a tuppenny tip for the waiter, which is kind of nice. So that's one and one for your dinner. Again, devoid of any vegetables or fruit. At least he has a bit of cheese. And there's two amounts of booze there, draft and port. And of course, drink was a big issue in Dublin at the time. Temperance movements springing up periodically.
We're very active.
Very active.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the city was full of pubs and, of course, people wanted to drink. They had miserable lives and it was one way of dealing with all of that.
Escaping us, yeah.
And then lastly, for the very well-off, you had Jamais. Jamais was the most beautiful restaurant in Dublin. It was still there when I was a child. I never actually got to eat in it. It was on Nassau Street and it was a French restaurant that served the most beautiful food. So if you wanted venison or lobster or oysters, all the menu was in French and it was very expensive. That was the place to go.
Katrina, stay with us because we're joined now by a woman whose name you will be hearing a lot of in the future, with numerous prizes for her short stories and work in non-fiction. Her debut novel, What Becomes of Us, was published last week and is in all good bookshops now. Henrietta McCurvey, you're welcome this morning.
Thank you very much.
And just first of all, yeah, the novel itself is set at an interesting time, not 1915, but 1965.
Yes, it's set mainly in 1965-66 with looks back to 1916 and a few years before that.
And the main character in the book is?
The main character is a woman called Maria Mills, who is Irish but has been living in London for 10 years and moves back to Dublin in 1965 and gets a job in RTE.
Go away. What was she doing in RTE?
She gets a job as a copy taker, which is a job that doesn't exist anymore. But it sounds really fascinating, I think, because copy takers were the people who would sit and wait to be phoned by reporters out in the field and would transcribe the reports and then pass them on to, you know, whatever department, news, wherever they were going. So in a way, they were the first audience for the news as it was coming in, and yet their job was merely just to transcribe it and pass it on.
Pass it on, yeah, not be telling people about it. And a lot of the novel is based around the 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising, or at least what this woman was doing for it.
Yes, that's right. Did you
have to do a lot of research then into 1915 and 1916 and what was happening?
I did, yes. It originally started, I mean, I had two points of interest coming into the book, I suppose. One was about 1916 and the role of women in 1916. And when I started to research, then I saw there was this massive gap. It's like women just went back into the kitchen for 50 years and came back out again in the 60s. And then you get the movements of, you know, the resurgent second wave of feminism, I suppose, from like 1968 on. And I was just really surprised about what had happened in the middle, you know, what hadn't happened in the middle. And then when I looked into it and I saw there was sort of fledgling campaigns starting in the mid-60s, like the Campaign for Pints, which is the one that I feature in the book, in which women would go into a pub and order a round of drinks.
I see.
And, you know, get their drinks, and then somebody would appear at the end and order a pint and, of course, be refused, because even the pubs where women could go or were allowed to go, they certainly wouldn't
serve them a pint.
No.
And
then they'd all be served out.
It was tremendous fun.
So I've heard.
You've done this yourself, Katrina.
Oh, yeah. There were three pubs on Stony Batter back in the 70s that wouldn't serve women pints. And we used to do exactly that. The other great thing was to order Irish coffee in that same way and then refuse to pay for it, because you can do nothing with an Irish coffee. It can't be recycled. You just have to throw it out.
Yes.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah. And it did actually change their minds in the end.
Yeah, well, I suppose it hit them in the wallet when it came to it. You know, because
it's
you have a group of women, and then I had this in the book where they all have to drink sippet at least. So they say, well, if you sippet, he can't pour it back in the bottle.
Yes, hard to see publicans in the days that we're in refusing pints to women. But when it comes to your novel, Henrietta, you also feature a lot about 1916 and the commemoration, the celebration of the commemoration. Was it completely different to what it is today?
Yes, it was. I think it was viewed in quite a different way, and certainly the role of women didn't really feature in the 50th anniversary commemoration at all. Even though Countess Markievicz, before the Rising, had identified the women's movement as being one of the three central issues, but it pretty much had disappeared by the time of the commemoration. So in the book, I have written about a radio programme that was being made about women's role in the Rising, but there wasn't such a programme.
Yes, and you point out also back in 1916 that the role of the women wasn't something that was highlighted and wasn't something that was appreciated.
No, not it wasn't particularly. I mean, amongst women as well, as Katrina was saying, you know, it wasn't often an issue amongst women, or in fact, it was an active non-issue for some of them. I have a character in the book talking about getting the vote and saying, I don't want to vote. I wouldn't know what to do with it. It felt like a burden to some people, you know, to get involved at all in that. But for those that did, they were incredibly active. Mm-hmm. And it's the numbers. What I found another thing interesting researching it was the fluctuation in the numbers of people who are involved. You know, at the time, it was assumed to be quite a small amount of women, but it's grown gradually. And certainly once there was access to military archives, the number has grown considerably once women who were involved were able to then claim pensions, military pensions.
So the number of women actually actively involved in 1916? Yes.
Well, it's now between 1916 and the War of Independence, it's now thought to be around 200.
Mm-hmm.
So, but certainly for around in the Rising, I think it's about 100.
About that. Well, they're divided, I suppose, between Cumann na mBan and the Citizen Army, which apparently Countess Markievicz was the only female member. But that it was a formality rather than the fact that they did not have women. The Irish Volunteers would not have women as members, which was a source of great annoyance to Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, who would have been one of the major suffrage organisers. And for that reason, she was opposed to Cumann na mBan. She felt it was just an auxiliary group of people who were there to do things for the men. And that is still a highly contested discussion. What was Cumann na mBan actually
the
doing?
The handmaidens to the revolutionaries.
I mean, we know the famous photograph of Constance Markievicz, who was a member of the Citizen Army in her uniform with her gun. But we don't see that of anyone else. So it's we're only in a way, in the last 10 years, we've started having that discussion about women's involvement in the revolutionary period and what exactly it means.
Yeah.
Started by Margaret Ward's great book, which really did change everything.
Yeah.
But we've a long way to go yet. Yeah. Lots more to find out.
And of course, there's the famous photograph of Nurse Elizabeth O'Farrell with Padraic Pearse, which I suppose in one way encapsulates so much of what was thought about the woman's role at the time. Mm-hmm. And the photograph, she was with him, she was next to him when he surrendered to Brigadier General Lowe. But her, in the early editions of the photograph, only her feet. You could just see her feet and the hem of her dress appearing. Mm-hmm. And in later editions, she was gone completely. Mm-hmm. And her role in that photograph, and in fact, her role in the entire surrender process, because she walked the city for 2 days, mm-hmm. taking notes of surrender to and from garrisons. And actually interesting with what you're saying about men's role, men's take on women's role, De Valera wouldn't accept a woman coming to his garrison mm-hmm. with a note to surrender.
Yeah. So he wouldn't accept it. So how was it? How was it relayed then?
Well, she had to go off again, as she said. She had a wasted trip. You know, she had to go off again, and then a man had to reappear.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
And what was RTE like back in? What sort of picture do you paint of RTE back in 1965?
Well, it's mixed. I think in one way it was probably a very exciting place to work. You know, it was all very new and the technology is new, the ideas, a lot of that are new. But I think for women in the 60s, I mean, it was probably, they got the duller end of the jobs, you know. I mean, the civil service marriage ban, obviously, was still in place. You know, women didn't have equal work or equal pay, and that wasn't particularly different here than in any other organisation.
Interesting indeed. And I know you mentioned the poverty levels that, Katrina, you were mentioning about 1915 and 1916. Was Dublin unique, or was this poverty, fairly a regular thing across Europe, in different countries across Europe?
Yes, but we had the worst slums in Europe. I mean, they were deemed to be the worst slums in Europe, worse than London, Birmingham or anywhere else. I mean, it was largely because of the poor quality of the housing. Tenement houses, which were degraded Georgian houses, which had been absolutely abandoned by their owners, many of whom were members of Dublin Corporation, as Mark said earlier on. But also people were living in little courts, almost all of which are gone now, which would be small little alleyways between houses in very run-down cottages that could date back to the 18th century also. So very poor, degraded housing conditions would have been the basic way of evaluating how bad this was. Mm. And we have to remember that tenement housing went on in Dublin until the 1970s. I remember tenement housing on Summerhill and Gardiner Street, which were then pulled down and new housing, private in one case, public in the other, put in their place. So it went on for a very long time. This is not unique to this period.
Mm. I'm going to change the subject, Henrietta, before I let you go. Last year you set out to travel to all the lighthouses featured in the BBC Radio Ship forecast. How did that go?
Yeah, it wasn't originally a lighthouse only trip. It was to explore the sea areas of the shipping forecast. And there's 31 sea areas that start off the coast of Norway and work its way around the UK and Ireland and end up back Iceland, with also hits off France and Spain as well. It's quite a big area to explore. So I didn't visit them all. So some I explored through folklore history, but there were a lot of lighthouses, as it turned out, if you can imagine.
And had you to go to a few?
Yes, I had a fantastic visit to Ballycotton Lighthouse, which is now open as a visitor attraction. I would really recommend it. And I also got an overnight stay on the Fastnet Lighthouse.
Which was so beautiful.
Which was such a privilege. Yeah. I mean, privilege, you know, / quite scary. Yeah.
Was it quite scary?
I found it, it is as terrifying, to be honest, I found, as it looks, those iconic photographs. There's this jagged rock, you know, on
it's
a calm
like the
day.
Skellig of lighthouses.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is. On a calm day, it's still breezy. Mm. I mean, I was clutching the observation desk, and one of the maintenance crew who was there with me was calling it a bit fresh. I was clutching onto the rail, you know,
God you live to tell the tale.
Yeah,
and perhaps we'll talk about that trip again. But for now, Henrietta McCurvey and Katrina Crowe, thanks very much.